Hello and welcome to We Are History. And if you heard last week's episode, then we have the same apology to make. Tell them what happened, Angela.
Yeah, you may remember at the beginning of last week's episode, we put in a little apology about the sound quality because John and I both managed to screw up our recordings. And so we had to use the Zoom recording that we'd made. And that's what we're having to do again for this episode because we'd recorded two episodes at the same time. Hopefully, by next week, you'll have back to our old standards.
I'm putting away that yoghurt carton and the piece of string. It was a waste of time.
Just got all soggy in the Atlantic, didn't it, John?
It did. Yeah. All right, so enjoy the show and apologies for the sound.
Welcome to We Are History with me, Angela Barnes.
And me, John O'Farrell.
John is going to be leading. Now, John, you made me read a book this week about the topic we were talking about. It's not that I didn't like the book. I like the writer and I like other stuff that he's done. Yeah. But I didn't enjoy, John, reading about the life of a certain Robert Maxwell.
Robert Maxwell is back in the news. We hear about Ghislaine Maxwell, and I find myself explaining to young people who Robert Maxwell was. And I thought, well, let's do a podcast about him. And as it happens, John Preston has written a book about him. John Preston is a great writer. He did the book on Thorpe that we did our podcast
The Very English Scandal?
Yes, that was televised. And so when I saw he'd done a book about Maxwell, I thought, oh, I'd like to read that. That's very interesting to me. And we could do a podcast about it because it's an incredible story about a monster, let's be honest.
And
you like to read about nice people, don't you, Angela?
I like to think that the world is full of nice people who are altruistic. But I also live in the real world, John, so it's fine. But I think it's a funny thing with Robert Maxwell because I remember, obviously, when he, spoiler alert, died. And how he died, we'll get onto all that later. But I remember it being in the news and obviously being a big thing. But I was really shocked to find out how long ago it was because in my head it was much more recent. It was 91. So when he died, I think he died just before my 16th birthday.
Okay.
Yet in my head, I feel like he was a presence for much more of my life than he was, you know, in terms of being in the news. And obviously people still talk about him and his death was talked about for a long time afterwards and stuff. But it really shocked me to go, God, did that really happen that long ago? And it did.
He was a big figure in the 60s. He was an MP and he was a figure in the 70s. I didn't really become aware of him until I was a graduate and he bought the Daily Mirror. And then he would not let you not be aware of him because he was on the front page every day.
Became his own sort of personal.
Yeah, it's a publicity machine. There were TV adverts and read the incredible life of Robert Maxwell and an advert for Robert Maxwell, you know. So, we'll talk about that when we get on to it. But so this week we're talking about the rise and fall. And fall is the title.
See what you did there, John?
That's the title of John Preston's book, which I have to say is a gripping read and I thoroughly recommend it. The other thing I'll say is that with Succession coming back, that's another reason.
I only watched the first episode of Succession and I didn't watch any more purely because I found it too depressing. I know people love it.
Yeah,
but I just really, it's bad enough that these people do exist. I don't need them interfere, you know, sort of, I just feel like I don't need them encroaching on my leisure time. Do you know what I mean?
So when you watch The Sound of Music, you know, you skip the bits of the Nazis.
I stop before the Nazis come. I do.
Just the children singing is all you want.
But the difference of that is, John, is that it's happened in the past. I can deal with the past.
History podcast, you know.
Yeah, I could cope with the past, but with the, you know.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I will go back to Succession, but maybe in 20 years.
So I don't think it's any coincidence that Jesse Armstrong put the climax to Series 2 on a luxury yacht, because that's where this story will end. And all through the sort of 80s when I started writing comedy and stuff, Maxwell and Murdoch were the great press baron rivals, but probably fair to say in the same way that Fulham think they're rivals to Chelsea, you know, Murdoch won out pretty well every time. Now, Succession isn't based on Maxwell.
That was hard for you to say that, wasn't it, John? Sorry, I just...
Yeah, it was, it was.
I could see that would really hurt having to say that. You mean that Chelsea always win? Is that what you meant?
Yes, all right, that's enough. Okay. They are champions of Europe, we got relegated, leave it. And Brentford got promoted, it gets worse. I know, you don't care. Yeah, I think Succession's got a touch of a lot more of Murdoch in it than Maxwell, except the sons. You know, the sons in Maxwell's, the browbeaten sons is very much from the Maxwell story. Mm-hmm. But if you did Maxwell's story as fiction, you wouldn't believe it. Before I read this book, I just thought he was just a pantomime villain, an egotistical, lying, cheating bully. Millions had been fraudulently accumulated. And mm-hmm. But of course, there's much more.
But he was all of those things.
He was, but he was also a brilliant man and a man who could learn languages at the drop of a hat, and the man who could memorize the science journal and talk about it. Obviously, had there a is, huge
I
brain.
I struggle with that, but he was a brilliant man. And I know what you mean. You mean he was an intelligent man and was able to, but brilliant, I'm not happy with that.
Well, in terms of the sense of, no, not emotional intelligence.
Clearly, I know what you mean.
In terms of ability to speak 8 languages or whatever, however many he spoke.
I know what you're saying. Yeah, and I agree. An incredibly intelligent man. I just struggle with abusive men being called brilliant because they're clever.
Okay. Oh, absolutely. I know
struggle
what you mean.
With that, I'm afraid.
He's a very capable man at advancing himself.
An intelligent man. I'll get, you know, because you can be intelligent and evil. But can you be brilliant and evil? That's different.
Okay. Oh, well, I'll give you that one. But, you know, he had an enormous capacity, enormous energy, enormous drive to advance Robert Maxwell at the expense of everyone else, including his own
family.
Kids,
right?
Kids and wife, yeah.
I just really struggle with these men who not only were they bullies, it's almost he ticked all the bully boxes so hard that so much of it just gets glossed over. You know, the fact that he beat his children and that he, you know, but there's a bit in the book where essentially he rapes a woman, and that's almost just sort of by the by.
He's such an ogre,
sense of absolute entitlement over particularly anyone that he sees as inferior to him, which is essentially everybody.
But what's fascinating is that he keeps getting away with it. He gets away with it, and he gets richer. Well, he apparently gets richer and richer, but it's all sort of money being moved around between bank and bank.
That's the thing with the super rich, isn't it? No one knows where the money is. That's the thing. Yeah. So you can tell people it exists and they'll believe you.
If you owe the bank £100, it's your problem. If you owe the bank £1 billion, it's their problem.
Oh.
Let's go back to the beginning, Angela.
Yes.
Born in a little village in rural Czechoslovakia. The main employment in the village was a salt mine.
All your hopes and dreams.
Here's the twist. Being Jews, because he was born into an Orthodox Jewish family, they weren't even allowed to work in the salt mine.
Right. It's so no sort of future in that village for young Robert Maxwell, was there?
No. Or Jan Hock, as it was called back then.
Jan Ludwig Hock. Is that right?
Yes. I think so. Yeah. But he changed his name many times, like 4 or 5 times by the time he was 23. 1939, war breaks out. Hungary, I think, nicked that bit of Czechoslovakia, and the Nazis were rising in Europe. He's like, I'm out of here. He's 16 years old. He says goodbye to his family. He'd never see most of them again because, of course, they were Jewish in Central Europe. In Maxwell's version, he walked 275 miles to Budapest, living off the land and dodging the authorities.
At 16.
Yeah. In his cousin's version, they got the train.
Right.
No, I know. You know, the other thing we say right up front about Maxwell, he was an inveterate liar and a man who would mythologize.
An embellisher of stories.
To nth degree. Yeah. So he said that he was captured and accused of being a spy and tortured, but as a spared execution because he was under 18. And then apparently he overpowered his one-armed guard, jumped off the lorry, and under a bridge, he found a gypsy woman who removed his handcuffs.
So
he told all this to Michael Parkinson on Desert Island Discs.
At no point Michael Parkinson goes,
Chinny Rick on. You have to understand back then, lots of bridges had gypsy ladies living underneath with a selection of lockpicks. That was very much the norm.
How did the gypsy lady get the handcuffs off? I mean, I'm asking questions that only Robert Maxwell can answer, seeing as it's a story that probably lives in his head.
He makes his way to Marseille, having escaped, and he volunteers for the French Foreign Legion, which is what you did back then. But of course, France being overrun by the Germans, he escapes from that and gets to England and learns English.
That was always in comics when I was growing up that you run away to join the French Foreign Legion. You never really hear about them now, do you?
No, still a thing?
Don't. I don't know.
Yeah, it's probably still a thing. I don't know.
So, yeah, he learns English in 6 weeks from a woman who ran a tobacconist shop in Sutton Coldfield, apparently, which doesn't make sense to me, John, because he'd end up talking like that, wouldn't he?
That would have been so
Hello,
different.
I'm Robert Maxwell.
That's a damned lie. Well, that's a lie.
I know, before anyone writes in, I know what I did then was a Birmingham accent, and Sutton Coldfield's not Birmingham, but it's all the same, isn't it?
No, in fact, his accent was modelled on Churchill's speeches, which he listened to before he understood them. And he had an extra sort of dollop of treacle. So his voice was very like this. And he sort of
said, that's a damn lie,
and I will sue you. Yeah, that's how he spoke.
Which is quite impressive, actually, though, to not only, I mean, he grew up speaking several languages, right? Czech, Hungarian, German, Russian, French, later English, Yiddish, of course.
Yeah.
So he was obviously a multilingualist, but in, to pick up an accent at 16 is actually really hard to do. And most people do linguistics, like they call it the critical window of picking up an accent is around puberty, really. So if you learn a new language after puberty, even if you're immersed in that culture, or if you move to a new town or whatever, you won't pick up the accent unless you do it very consciously.
Oh, well, that's
and,
what it
and
was.
Then, which is obviously what he did. But it's still very difficult for a foreign ear to pick up a foreign accent. Really difficult. So, you know, it's quite amazing what he was able to do, really.
There was no hint that he sounded Czech or anything, you know.
No, no.
Or Ukrainian or wherever it ended up being part of Hungary. So where were we? He's 17.
So he's 17. He's in Britain.
And he's in the Pioneer Corps, which is this place they stuck all the foreigners. And the British thanked him for his volunteering by sending him off to South Wales to break rocks. Not a very grateful way to treat volunteers from occupied Central Europe.
Yeah.
He did that for quite a long time. He was stuck out there.
Wow, changed in his Wales, name to, breaking rocks.
Yeah, he changed his name to Ivan du Maurier.
Right, because just to mix him with the locals in Wales.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, it's Ivan the Rock. So that was the name of a popular brand of cigarettes, was Du Maurier. So sophisticated. Most of the war he was in England, you know, or Wales, in the UK anyway. 1944 he managed to get himself transferred to a British regiment, and then 3 weeks after D-Day he got to northern France.
I suppose he spoke German, so they thought he'd be useful, right?
Yeah. He slightly alarmed them when he demonstrated this by turning up in a Nazi uniform and said, you know, I could go undercover. It's like, whoa, it's a fucking Nazi.
Oh, take that off.
Yeah. By this time, he changed his name to Leslie Smith.
Right.
That's like the fourth time he changed his name. The bank wrote to him and said, if you change his name once again, they're closing your account immediately.
Oh, my goodness me. I tell you, as somebody who's currently changed their name by Deepol, as I have. So I am keeping my name professionally, but I've changed my name personally. And, it's a ball eight, John.
Oh, it is.
So to do it like the six times banks. Before you're 23, gee
the
whiz.
Poor banks. But to be fair, this would not be the biggest inconvenience that probably whatever would cause the banks.
No, not by a long chalk. So then he gets promoted to sergeant, and apparently he does show great bravery and disregard for his own personal safety. In one battle, he disobeyed orders and ended up saving the lives of his platoon as a result by insisting on going back in, I think, to a raid that they'd sort of given up on. John Preston, in this book, he does suggest that there's something in that story that's true, right? Even though it feels like it's all Maxwell's heroic stories.
Yeah, but it is that disregarding authority and lives were saved. Yeah. Because, I mean, however much he might have built it up or spun it, he was awarded the Military Cross by General Montgomery.
Yeah, and there's a photograph of him receiving it, because that does sound like, oh, yeah, of course he got the Military Cross, but actually he did. And I do think, you know, I assume, knowing what I know about Robert Maxwell, that, like you say, his sort of motivation for going back into that situation, I don't think was to particularly to rescue people, as to elevate Robert Maxwell, right?
Well,
as the
maybe,
hero.
But he did save some lives, apparently. So,
oh, yeah,
giving,
but
I'll
I mean,
that
you
one.
Know,
I'll give him that one. Because, but...
Yeah, he saved the, don't get me wrong, he saved the lives, but I'm sure it was to for him to be a hero was the, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, he did see quite a lot of action, and he killed a large number of Germans, but when a group of Germans surrendered, because when he got promoted, you know, he was in charge of sort of a small platoon, and a group of Germans surrendered, they all came out with their hands up, and Maxwell shot them all dead.
Jesus.
And he was surprised when all the young men under his command thought that was unfair.
Yeah, if you've got surrendering soldiers, you take them as prisoners of war. You don't shoot them in the head, do you?
Yeah. So he got some leave, and he went on a motorbike to Paris, and there he met in the city of love.
He met Betty.
Poor Betty. Who would become his wife.
Did you find, John, in the book, like Betty, the bits of Betty's diaries where she's talking about their sex life, I had to sort of tune out a little bit.
No, that it turned me on, that stuff. Yeah.
Oh, did it? Okay, well, you know, whatever floats your boat, John O'Farrell.
I jest, of course. The idea of Robert Maxwell on top of you, it's not, you know, it's not designed to, you know, stimulate. Mm-hmm. They were married in March 44, and he returned to the army. He sent her a list of what would make the perfect marriage. Did you do this, Angela?
Well, Matt did this to me, obviously. He sent me a list.
Number one.
We were getting married, said, right, this is how you have a perfect marriage. And go on, well, John, you say what's on the list.
Number one, don't nag. Number two, don't criticize unduly. There were six of these. I'm not going to read them all out.
Makes me feel sick. It's just...
Did you not do this? I thought everyone did this.
It's that real thing of that person in a marriage, usually the man, who just... It's not about a marriage, is it? It's about how you serve me. It's about...
Exactly.
He's employed a maid is what he's done. He hasn't married... It's not a partnership, is it? It's this is how you serve me in our future together.
Absolutely. So poor Betty was, they were in love, I think, to start with, but God, she had a pretty hard time.
Bloody hell, didn't she?
He was one of nine children in growing up, and he had this ambition to replace his family. Because I should say, the day before he got that military cross, he learned that his mother and one of his sisters had been murdered by the Nazis. He was a victim of the Holocaust in the sense that his family had been wiped out. He wanted to have nine children.
There's a theory about how he became. I mean, obviously, you know, something like that happens to you at a relatively young age. That is going to inform how you develop as a human being.
Absolutely.
But also, I think it said he was his mother's favourite, wasn't it? I think his mother really mollycoddled him, and he sort of, when she died, it obviously affected him very badly, but he also was sort of looking for that mollycoddling, you know, expected treatment from everyone to be, of the favourite child, obviously.
Yeah. So anyway, we're in post-war Berlin, and he gets himself a dog from the breeder who'd supplied Hitler with his dog, which his fellow officers were not wild about. Do you know what Hitler's dog was called, Angela?
Blondie.
That's right. It was a massive Debbie Harry fan.
Hey, I'll set him up. You knock him down, John.
I bet we've done that joke in a previous one.
Almost.
We're getting to the point now where we're just repeating the same jokes. In post-war Berlin, Maxwell's in charge of public relations and the information services control press section. So he starts a German language newspaper. Oh, there's a little note for later. And it's a great success. There's very little information for the poor occupied Germans. I say poor occupied Germans. They did sort of destroy Europe, but, you know, they're victims of Hitler as well. Maxwell is only 23 and he's sort of starting to demonstrate this genius for browbeating, bullying, bartering, haggling, and getting his whatever Robert Maxwell wants. And so he's thinking, how can I make my millions? All those years he spent breaking rocks in South Wales, he spent time thinking of money-making plans. And he meets someone, doesn't he, Angela?
He does. He meets Ferdinand Springer, who, before the war, he'd published books by the world's leading scientists.
And he was a German,
It was a German, And obviously everything in 1945 is in flux. There's shortage of paper. And Maxwell sees this opportunity here to get rich. 63,000 books have been removed from Berlin to this big warehouse for safekeeping. And Maxwell secured worldwide distribution rights for these books.
Because Germans
at a time
allowed.
When Germans aren't allowed to send anything abroad.
These are science books, you know, books by, you know, Einstein and all the, from all sorts of really obscure science things. But, you know, scientists around the world and universities around the world all want to copy these books. So there's a sitting market, you know, for these things. And Maxwell realizes that there's nothing like this in Britain. So he organizes this huge convoy of trucks that arrive in London with all these books. It's not clear where he got the money to arrange all of this, you know.
At 23, wasn't he, as well, at the time?
There's railway carriages full of books, and they're all turning up in London, and he's getting warehouses to store them in. But, you know, later on he would prove he's very good at borrowing money.
And he obviously can sweet talk a bank or two, can't he?
There's also a suggestion he got some money from MI5 while in Berlin. So he might have been operating, you know, as a bit of a spy. His file said he was a dashing fellow, looked like Clark Gable.
You see, the Robert Maxwell that I've seen...
It's not doing it for you, is it, Angela?
I can't imagine it. But then we were all younger once, you know. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, so he demobbed. He set up office in London. Mm-hmm. Did you read that story about the dummy phone? I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah, brilliant. A dummy phone in his office. He would press a button, wouldn't he, to make it ring, like a secret button. So he'd take a call during a meeting and then he'd speak a foreign language. So just to make himself look important.
No one on
whoever
the other
he was having a meeting with. No one on the other end, no.
Yeah, I might start doing that with my mobile. So by now he'd settled on the name Robert Maxwell. He thought, what can I call my building? I'll call it Maxwell House. This cafe was already taken.
Well, the coffee maker's not too happy, apparently. Obviously, that already was a brand. But
But he,
you know, it never bothered Robert Maxwell to nick things from people, did it?
No. So he appeared to be making a fortune publishing these scientific journals. And he was sort of, you know, purported to be idealistic about the work he was doing, you know, about science and the future. And the bomb at Hiroshima persuaded me that
he was very, the whole kind of nuclear race that was going on and stuff. And he was sort of interested in all that, wasn't he? And of course, just constantly borrowing money and these businesses.
He was constantly borrowing beyond his means, of course, switching loans from one company to the other. And in 1955, his creditors call in the official receiver, who said it was doubtful the company was at any time solvent.
So he was just going loan to loan and winging it.
Yeah, yeah. And then sort of getting all these loans that he couldn't pay back and playing loans off against each other and using one loan to sort of secure the capital to get another loan or whatever.
Yeah.
He reckoned he'd been picked on by the British establishment, of course.
Well, that's just, it's always, you know, whenever someone gets found out, it's that they've been picked on, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And then just to add insult to injury, he was told he only had 4 weeks to live.
Yeah, he was told he had cancer, wasn't it? Liver,
yeah,
was
lung
it,
cancer.
I think?
Lung. Kid,
no, lung, that's right.
Yeah.
I mean, that section of the book is quite, yeah, his children have been brought in one by one to say goodbye to him, and he was going under the knife, and it turned out to be a completely false diagnosis.
Yeah, we could get a second opinion, Robert. Oh, yeah, it's like, oh, no, you're fine. Yeah.
They said there was one shadow on the lung or something, but it was something really innocuous.
They did remove half a lung, I think.
Benign.
They did remove,
But
I think perhaps his brush with death made him more determined to achieve his ambitions. You know, he was incredibly energetic and psyched up sort of character. Couldn't sit in a taxi without shouting instructions at the driver the whole time.
Listen to the way he spoke to drivers. And there was one incident, I think, later on where he was trying to get, there was a new driver, a new chauffeur he had, and he was trying to get somewhere and kept instructing him to go through red lights in London. And the driver was like, well, I can't do that. And in the end, he just made the driver get out and drove the car himself and just left the driver on the side of the road.
Yeah, and there's one time where he was done for dangerous driving. He'd been driving at 90 miles an hour in his Rolls Royce while shaving. In the mirror. It's like, you're not allowed to do this anymore. It's like health and safety gone mad.
Gone mad, isn't it?
So he always had this ambition to be a sort of English squire, and he identified this ruin near Oxford owned by the council. He didn't want to buy it. He said he'd pay for the repairs if the council let him rent it. So Oxford County Council were like, great, best, you know, you do it up. He lived in Headington Hall. And he said it was
best council house in the country.
Best council house in the country is what he said. Poor Betty duly produced 9 children, and his family life sounded pretty grim, didn't it, Angela?
Yeah, well, the children, he would make them give speeches at dinner. They had to, on Christmas Day, there's one bit where they described their Christmas Day and they would all have to get up and talk about their hopes for the future. And if they stammered or stuttered,
it's like, that's mental laziness, you know.
Yeah, berate them and would physically beat them as well with a belt, the boys and the girls.
Yeah.
If they crossed him or showed inattentiveness or disrespect to him. He was a narcissist, a plain narcissistic bully.
Yeah, yeah. And Betty would give him half the turkey and everyone else had to share the rest.
Like,
he was a glutton as well. He was a glutton as well. So these poor kids. The eldest was actually tragically involved in a car accident. He spent 7 years in a coma before finally dying. And now Betty thought her husband never once visited his unconscious son in hospital. But the chauffeur, you know, said that they often called in late at night when he was on the way back. But he never told his wife that he'd gone
to see the son.
I mean, that's what sort of marriage is that? Where you don't say, oh, I went to see our, you know, unconscious son. Never mentioned it. And of course, he was having affairs all this time. And when Betty found out about one woman, she insisted he was moved out of Maxwell's office and he moved her to the New York office. But that wasn't far enough. So they moved her to Tibet.
It's just this sort of, you read this a lot when you read sort of biographies of these, you know, significant men. And the way the women are talked about in their lives, like they're not people. They're just these women that come along and are used and then go. And then another one, she got moved to. You go, these are people with lives as big
lives.
As his.
I know.
And we just sort of go, oh, and there was another one. And he had these affairs. And I'm like, this is an indicator of, you know, royals and politicians that all sucked up to it. And they just look past the way that these men treated women. I hope it's changing because.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. There'll be characters.
It should
like
be
this.
A real signifier, shouldn't it? That someone's a woman.
Well, it's quite interesting. I mean, you had things like Me Too come along and that sort of behavior was stopped. But here in New York, said John, dropping this in.
Where are you, John?
I'm in New York, but the in theatre land. But Scott Rudin has basically been sort of cancelled for just being a terrible bully. There's not specific incidents, not like a list of rapes or anything. He has just behaved appallingly to his staff, and one assistant committed suicide. But it sort of feels like a step beyond. It's sort of what you're talking about. We're saying you can't behave like that anymore. We're not going to put up with it. So I hope we, like you say, I hope we're moving forward on these things. Yeah. People who behave like monsters are going to get called out on it.
Yeah, because it's not, it's pure narcissism, and there's just no need for it. It's always seen, wasn't it, that that was a strength. If you could put fear in people, that then you were strong. When actually it's just, no, it's horrific.
I mean, what's terrible is how far he got and how powerful he became because he behaved like this appalling monster. I mean, absolutely. So I wonder, at the end of one dinner party in the 1950s, Maxwell announced, "I've decided to become prime minister." Which party?
See, wouldn't your alarm bells be ringing then? As soon as somebody said, "I've decided to become prime minister," I'd be like, "Well, you're a fucking idiot."
Yeah, exactly. Well, I don't think I'll come to dinner party with you again. He goes, "Which party?" "Well, of course I'm a conservative, but I'm not a member of the establishment, the British establishment. So I'm going to have to become Labour." So he got
and again, there, John, that is a perfect example, isn't it, of how somebody's utterly self-serving. It's not
totally
about...
Totally cynical, yeah.
Yeah, it's not remotely about what you believe in, what you, you know, wanting to do some good, wanting to make change. It's pure narcissism. You're not going to be a conservative because you, you know, you have to be Labour in order to be elected. It's just...
Yeah, I know, yeah. So
anyway, sorry, I'll start. It just really upsets me, this man.
Thank you, caller. No, I get it. He's outrageous. Yeah. But that's why I think he's so interesting, because it's not like we're talking about a loser. We're talking about somebody who all through his life went from one success to apparently one success to another all the time, borrowed money on other people's labours.
Yeah.
Captain Robert Maxwell, as he styled himself, stood for Labour in Buckingham, which doesn't sound like a very Labour seat. It had been Labour in 45, but he lost it in 59. But in 64, when Labour came to power with a tiny majority, Labour won the seat. So... He was called up by he's an MP, suddenly Robert Maxwell is an MP. He was called up by the Jewish Chronicle, who said how delighted they were that there was a new Jewish MP. And he said, "I'm not Jewish." And he hung up.
he would regularly deny his past, wouldn't he? And then, and then not when it suited him.
And then towards the end of his life, he became sort of very interested in his heritage.
Yeah.
But he had all these companies and he was constantly moving money around and loans between them all. But his main business was Pergamon Press, which was run out of Headington Hall in Oxford. And John Preston says, you know, he did revolutionise scientific publishing in this country. And that could have just been his legacy had he not been a megalomaniac, fraudster and sociopath.
Yes.
Little faults, but they create problems for those around you.
Greed breeds greed. And what could have been just a successful business, could have been an incredibly wealthy man and successful. Yeah. It's not enough, is it, for these people? It's not enough. They have to be the top of everything.
So he's in the House of Commons, driving all the other MPs mad with boredom and irritation. Instead of, you know, he doesn't wait to make his maiden speech, just gets up and jumps up and down in every
He made his maiden speech and his first appearance in the House of Commons. That's not done, is it? That's not what you do, but that's how self-important he was.
Yeah, yeah. They put him in charge of the House of Commons catering. And,
just to keep him out their way.
And it wasn't... No, it was the books that were being cooked as well as the food is what the illusion. And he sold off the incredible wine cellar to well below market value to an anonymous buyer. I wonder who that anonymous buyer was, Angela.
Well, suffice to say, any politicians visiting Headington Hall afterwards might have recognised the wine served at dinner.
He's always on the lookout for next money-making scam. And he had this plan to sell encyclopedias in Australia. So he called up this Australian businessman, a newspaper man called Rupert Murdoch.
Oh, I've heard of him.
Yeah, and Murdoch was in awe of Maxwell at this point and agreed to spend $1 million Australian on his books. They were going to become business partners and they were going to have lunch in London. And then Murdoch told someone his plan and the other guy burst out laughing and went, "Don't go near that bloke. He's an absolute con man and fraudster." And Murdoch cancelled the whole deal and... Poor Maxwell never knew that he'd spend the rest of his life trying to chase Murdoch.
Because Maxwell thought him and Murdoch were the same, didn't he? And like you say, they just were different leagues, really. I mean, they were obviously compared a lot and they were, you know.
Murdoch never put himself all over the front page of his papers for a start. He was about the business, not about the ego.
Yeah, I mean, Murdoch's a megalomaniac in a completely different way.
Absolutely, Maxwell failed to get the News of the World. Then Murdoch gets the Sun in 69, a bit later. Mm-hmm. And so Maxwell's got nothing. He loses control of his beloved Pergamon Press. The locks were changed on the building next door and their shared basement is blocked out from getting under there to get access to all his papers.
So this is his big company next to where he lives.
Go on. And the Department of Trade said he's not a person who can be relied upon to exercise proper stewardship of a publicly quoted company.
If only people had listened to that. We're in the late 60s. He's lost his business, his reputation. And the following year, he loses his seat in Parliament. So was it all over? The man that they nicknamed the bouncing check? Or would he bounce back, John? And become
back.
Even more infamous and influential?
Find out after this break. Dun, dun, dun.
Hello, welcome back to We Are History. You probably heard an advert then for Robert Maxwell's latest business venture. Oh no, sorry, that we're not in the 70s. In fact, the 70s, not a great time for Maxwell, were they, John?
He stood for Parliament twice and lost in 74, defeated both times.
Murdoch, of course, owns The Sun by now, which becomes the best-selling paper in the country. Maxwell still has no newspapers. He's a press baron with no press.
Yeah, in October 90, The Times is in trouble. Maxwell thinks, I'm going to try and buy that. But no, guess who gets it?
Outmaneuvered again by old Murdoch.
Three times in
Chelsea
a row.
Fulham all over again, John.
It is Chelsea Fulham all over. You don't have to remind me. He'd been ousted from Pergamum, but it's performing badly under its new management because they're not submitting fraudulent accounts. And he manages to wrest back control of it using borrowed funds.
Using borrowed funds, of course, using borrowed funds, yes.
And then in 1984, his chance finally comes. What happens
after? £80 million that he didn't actually have, John, but as we know, that doesn't matter when you're super rich. Yeah. He bought the Daily Mirror, the big rival to the Murdoch's Sun. And of course, since the Sun had gone Tory, the only Labour-supporting tabloid.
Finally, at the age of 61, he's got a major newspaper. He couldn't be ignored. And Maxwell and Murdoch were the two biggest players in Fleet Street.
He's there. He's up there with Murdoch.
And this is when I think I became aware of Maxwell. It was hard not to. Then suddenly he had his finger in every pie. He bought Oxford United. You know, clubs have sponsors on their shirts. You know what it said on Oxford United shirts?
Go on.
Maxwell.
Oh, God.
It just said Maxwell.
Just like, Maxwell.
Yeah, he tried to merge them with...
Nobody noticed that he was a narcissist, John.
I know. He had a company called Maxwell, but he didn't put, Maxwell Communications. He just put Maxwell.
Maxwell.
And he tried to merge them with Reading and call them Thames Valley Royals, which is not a popular... Football fans love that. They love having been merged with their local...
Yeah, so with their local rivals. Yeah, love it.
And then he tried to buy Manchester United, which, of course, Murdoch did later on, but he refused the owner's asking price. So his ego was massive. They said he was
always in the mirror, wasn't he? I remember that from when I was younger. Like he was always in it, and he was on the adverts on telly for the Mirror, and it was he wasn't like a silent partner, was he?
They said he couldn't see a spotlight without running into it. One of his Christmas cards was a big picture of him from his birthday party back in June, standing under a banner saying "Happy Birthday, Bob." And one of his business acquaintances says, "You can't do that, Bob." And he was like, "What?" He said, "The thing about Christmas cards is they're not supposed to be about Happy Birthday, Bob. They're supposed to be about Happy Birthday, Jesus."
just no self-awareness, is there at all? He even tried to muscle in on Band-Aid, didn't he, on Live
That's
Aid?
Right.
And their mission to Ethiopia, tried to make it all about him. So Alistair Campbell at the time worked for The Mirror, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right. He's embarrassed about what he wrote now.
And he is embarrassed because he wrote, and obviously he's, working for Maxwell, and he wrote, "Starving children were saved yesterday thanks to the intervention of Mirror publisher Robert Maxwell."
Oh, my God. And then there's a great bit in Bob Geldof's memoir, which I read recently. It's about how he quickly realised what Maxwell was about and kept him at arm's length. But
he didn't care about starving children, did he?
No, he cared about Robert
Maxwell. He saw a bandwagon.
Yeah. I mean, the other book I read about Maxwell, I should say this now, is Roy Greenslade's book on him, which I've read many years ago. And Greenslade was his editor at the Daily Mirror.
Yeah.
And he talks about instructing him to fix the £1 million spot the ball competition so that no one won the £1 million. He's basically instructing his editor to commit fraud. The thing I remember most about that book, and this is 20 plus years since I read it, but that Greenslade remembers seeing Maxwell floored by one particular accusation. He was always so good at going, "That is an absolute lie and I shall sue you and that, everything." But there was one thing he was accused of, and he stammered and stuttered. And I think it was something like, "Did you work for Mossad or something?" I can't remember what the details were. But he appeared really hurt and upset and couldn't cope with this accusation. And Greenslade concluded that this is because it's the only accusation leveled against him that wasn't true. So everything else he was accused of was like, "Did you steal the pension funds? How dare you say that?" Because he was thinking in his head, "Oh, yeah, I did. I better be really strong." But when it's something, he was accused of something he hadn't done, he didn't know how to cope with it.
That's mad. When it's actually unjust, he couldn't. react. So obviously Mirror goes strength to strength, right, John, with Robert Maxwell at the helm.
Guess what?
No.
No, the Mirror circulation drops 500,000 in a year. Pretty much wow. like everything he got involved in, he made it worse. So
he really didn't he? Yet people still kept giving him money. It just makes no sense.
When I was at Spit and Image, we did a sketch. I wasn't the one who wrote it, but I was in the offices at the time. It was an inverted King Midas sketch in which everything Maxwell touched turned to shit. And we couldn't say shit for some reason. So it was everything's turned to four. And he'd smell it. But whenever you did a Maxwell sketch, and I did the sketch, and I did this on radio and TV, then lawyers would be all over it. And it'd be like not worth doing for the amount it would cost the production company in legal fees to check it. So he would sue at the drop of a hat. He'd bully you into apologies. And we actually did a sketch of him singing Putting Out the Writs, WRITS. And ironically, the lawyers were so worried that he would issue a writ about that, listed all the people he'd sued, and we had to make sure we weren't at the end of that list. So that took loads of money and time. And that was that's how he worked, bullying people and suing them. He successfully sued Private Eye, who always take the piss out, and called him Captain Bob and the bouncing check. But he launched a one-off spoof of the magazine called Not Private Eye. Guess whether it was really funny or not.
God, what a great pun.
It was terrible. Brilliant. I remember it. It was on all the newsstands. I thought, this is shit. And of course it was. It was like a comic going, I hate this joke about me. I'm going to get up at the Comedy Store and tell jokes about them. Do you know what I mean?
But also, bullies, it's like the Donald Trump thing, you know.
Yes. Similar.
People who are narcissists and particularly that sort of weird right-wing ideology or just that kind of cannot... haven't got a sense of humor.
No, absolutely.
About themselves, and they cannot do a joke which is why you end up with Donald Trump thinks it's funny to mock a disabled person or something because he hasn't got the capability.
Empathy, or
anything to actually be funny, right? They've got zero sense of humor. It fascinates me that's why they end up where money's so important to them, because that's how they attract people, because their personality doesn't.
Absolutely. Yeah. You're so emphatic there. You hit your...
I did. Glass, I hit my wedding ring on my glass.
So you're drinking beer because it's the evening for you, and I'm drinking tea because it's the afternoon for me.
Although I have been drinking beer since the afternoon.
Fair enough. You're a married woman now. You can do what you want. So 1987. Right. 1987, he launched the London Daily Paper. And I remember this very clearly because I was in London. I was active in politics. And we thought, great, there's going to be a Labour-supporting evening paper in London. The Standard was right-wing rag. In a Labour city. And we were like, great, there's going to be a newspaper setting the Labour agenda in when we're battling sort of the Wandsworth Tories or whatever.
At no point you were going, I wish it wasn't Robert Maxwell, though.
I was at some level, but it's like, you work with who you can work with.
Yeah.
So at the press conference announcing it, he just says completely off the top of his head, this is going to be a 24-hour paper changing throughout the day and night. And the people sitting next to him are going, what the fuck? How are we going to do that? Have you checked that we've got the presses for that, that we have the staff?
They'd just be constant new editions all day?
All through 24 hours. And it was like a
24-hour rolling news, but on paper.
On paper, yeah. And it's like, there's not many paper sellers at 3 a.m. outside the tube station. Do you know what I mean? It was a terrible idea. The Evening Standard launched the evening news just to confuse everybody. So for a while, London had 3 daily papers. But after 5 months, it closed down. It was like, oh, shit, there we go. And they had some good people on it. They had, like Duncan Campbell and... I think Alan Rusbridger might have worked on it. Everything he did went wrong, basically. I'm not going to go into details. There's lots of detail in the book about his spiraling debt problems and Maxwell Communications owing £2.4 billion.
See, why don't you start owing £2.4 billion? Like, numbers just stop meaning anything. It's exactly what you said before about you owe the bank £100. But £2.4 billion,
And Maxwell was getting fatter and fatter. He was behaving more erratically.
In the book, it did sort of insinuate that he had a kind of eating disorder, didn't it, really? Because of coming from such scarcity as a child.
He grew up in poverty. But
had real issues with food.
Yeah, there was an account of him having some sort of editor or something to dinner, and the waiter or the butler serving this lamb onto the guest's plate first, and Maxwell just taking the food off his guest's plate and putting it in his mouth because he was like, couldn't wait to have this sort of meat.
Because he had a housekeeper, I think, wasn't it, who sort of really watched what he ate and sort of would lock the kitchen, but then Maxwell in the middle of the night would break the lock off the kitchen door and gorge himself on all the food. It was like a child. He was a child, really, like a spoiled, petulant child.
He did completely regress. I mean, there was things like him wiping his bottom on the towels and leaving the maids to clean the towels. Yeah. It's like bizarre behaviour. I mean, just becoming into complete Peter Jay said that he wasn't amoral, he was sort of pre-moral. He was like sort of from another world where there were no morals, you know.
Yeah.
It's hard to know,
isn't it? When he's doing things like wiping his ass on a towel and leaving it for someone else, you're like, is that just for sheer disrespect for other humans, or is it just not functioning as a, you know, just not, just being really...
Self-loathing, maybe.
Yeah, or just really sort of childlike almost, isn't it?
Yeah. We're into 1990 now, and he tells his wife his marriage is over, and he refused to explain gaps in the mirror finances to the senior staff, raising questions. All his children working for most of them. They were terrified.
On and off. I mean, he'd sack them at the drop of a hat, wouldn't he? And then re-employ them, and he treated them terribly.
They weren't going to push back when he said the money's all there, it's in Liechtenstein or whatever. He bought the ailing New York Daily News and he rang up Rupert Murdoch. He wanted to hear his reaction when he told him the news. And Murdoch just burst out laughing and put the phone down.
I bet he did.
But then there's a recession as well. So with the creditors calling in their debts, it becomes harder and harder for him to keep moving his debts around, and his smoke and mirrors act was falling apart. October 91, five UK banks selling their shares. Goldman Sachs sold their shares in Mirror Group newspapers and in Pergamon, whatever. Swiss banks said they were going to alert the authorities of suspected breaches of the law. Everything's closing.
They're coming for him, are they, John? It's all closing in.
Where'd you go, Angela? What'd you do?
Well, you get on your yacht, John.
That's what I always do in these situations.
I get on my luxury yacht.
It wasn't a narrowboat, Angela. It wasn't a little narrowboat at Oxford. No. It was a big luxury £1 billion yacht over in Gibraltar. He had it.
Yeah, the Lady Ghislaine.
Lady Ghislaine, named after his favourite
daughter.
Ghislaine Maxwell.
Who in the book, I mean, this is, you know, I mean, it's no surprise that this is an incredibly dysfunctional family in many ways. And he would beat his children, but then he had a favourite, Ghislaine, who was the youngest and would.
Yeah.
But then it said that she had an eating disorder by the time she was 3.
Yeah. And she stood in front of her mum and said, "Mummy, I exist." When she was like two and a half, three. It's like, wow. It's fucked up, man.
Yeah.
It is. The crew of the boat were like, oh God, we weren't expecting this at all. They had no food for him, no preparations, and they knew.
And I'm sure Maxwell takes that fine if he turns up somewhere and they, you know, don't have a load of food in. I'm sure he's fine with that.
Yeah, and they were aware of his terrible temper and they feared the worst. Yeah. But guess what happened?
He was nice to everybody. That must have scared them more, right? Than
like, what's
just
going on here?
Them all and,
Maxwell's being really nice. And so he had a few days on the boat. They went to Madeira and they sailed around the Canary Islands.
Oh God, imagine just having a yacht there. You could just go and get on it and just sail around Madeira.
I don't think I'd like it, Angela. It's just that money that you're burning.
Well, yeah, that's you prefer your little narrowboat in Oxfordshire.
My little narrowboat. So my flight out to New York, right, it's like the company, it's in my contract, they fly me first class out to New York, but I booked it. I went online and it was like premium economy, which is still perfectly fine, nice.
Yeah.
It was like 800 quid or something. To go first class, and they're paying for it, it was $6,500. I'm not making anyone spend $6,500 to sit in a slightly bigger chair for 8 hours. It's ridiculous. Yeah. So I've just booked premium economy. They're going, people over here are going, Jonas, you're not paying for it. It's like, I can't bear the waste and the excess.
It's such waste. Money doesn't mean anything, does it? Because they're borrowing it most of the time anyway.
Also, I think it's a bit ungreen, isn't it, to have all that space on a plane. So I went for the cheaper one, Andrew. I hope you'll
good
think
for you,
I'm not
John.
Like Maxwell.
I'm proud of you.
I'm not Maxwell, am I? Tell me I'm not like Maxwell.
Not in that respect, John, no.
That's a bloody lie, I'll sue. So I wouldn't like a big luxury yacht. I like a little narrowboat, that's fine. But it costs about the same as a car, if anyone's interested. But anyway, he's got enough about my narrowboat. It's November the 5th. Things are closing around.
Yes.
He's supposed to be meeting the governor of the Bank of England. His sons are being interviewed by the Financial Times at 6 a.m. His son's call is put through to the cabin and there's no reply.
Yeah.
Further calls not picked up. The crew starts concerned that both the doors to his stateroom are locked. Well, that's odd.
Yeah.
Finally, at mid-morning, they fetch the passkey and just found his crumpled dressing gown on the floor.
And that's when they search the yacht and Maxwell... Yeah. Nowhere to be found on the yacht. And they said they did several searches. They even looked in drawers. So I don't know what size the drawers would have had to be for Maxwell to get in one. But
So I remember being on the tube and just seeing the front page of the Standard and it's like Maxwell disappears at sea. It was like, what the hell?
Yeah.
That was like such a surprising bit of news. And in the book, he cuts straight to his body was found. But that was a good bit of, there was a lot of news in between of us going, what the hell? Has he disappeared? Has he done a runner? And then they find the body. And that's how you saw news stories back then, on a newspaper headline. It's like, extra, extra, read all about it. Maxwell disappears. It's like something from a movie. You know? I remember thinking, what the fuck? Has he just disappeared? Has he done a John Stonehouse?
I can remember it being on the news. I was, 15, 16. I remember watching it unfold. And it was...
Yeah. Has he faked a suicide? Has he killed himself? What?
Yeah.
The news was full of it. And then at the end of the day, the news comes that an aerial search crew has found this body and it was being hauled out of the water. And that must be quite a job.
Yeah, well, it was by all accounts. The diver had to, it described it in the book. I can't remember what they had to use in the end, but it was something.
Or helicopter was like, I can't do it.
I think it's like a special bag they tried to roll him into and that didn't work. Yeah. And they had to get like a big harness thing.
That's right. And then they couldn't find a coffin big enough to put him in. So, all sorts of crazy theories were put about. Did he jump? Was he murdered by the Israeli Secret Service, which seems a bit unlikely since Israel gave him a virtual state funeral?
Although, they would do, wouldn't they?
Okay. Yeah.
You're trying to cover it up. You know, just saying.
Make too much effort the other way, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Was the body a double? Like Operation Mincemeat. What's Operation
Mincemeat, John? Answer? We've done a podcast about that. Exactly. When a Welsh tramp was substituted for a body of a
British soldier.
So
maybe the body found was someone else. I mean, no one will ever know. But the things that convinced the captain that he had chosen to jump and taken his own life at this point of maximum crisis in his economic affairs was A, the fact that he locked both doors to his stateroom. Why would he do that unless he didn't want anyone finding he was gone until it was too late? But the insurance company, not wanting to pay out 20 million quid if it was suicide, cited the fact that he was so nice as proof that he must have been planning beforehand. It can't have been an accident. He's never nice. He was nice. That's proof that he was trying to sort of make people think
that something was going on. There's quite a lot of theories, aren't there? Because I know there's one theory about his hair colour, because he dyed his hair black quite famously, and that his hair wasn't black when they recovered it. And, you know, there's lots of things about whether he drowned or not drowned, because apparently, you know, there were certain organisms that they would expect to be present that weren't.
Yeah.
Lots of sort of things, but nothing really could explain it, could it?
Yeah, and it was a rushed post-mortem. Because he wanted to be buried under sort of Orthodox Jewish law, it had to be really quickly. And then
5 days, isn't it? Yeah.
And then before sunset on the Sabbath in Israel and all that shit. So no disrespect to Orthodox Jews, but all that shit. And so that increased the sense of conspiracy and cover-up, I think.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now? The politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann-Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
His obituaries obviously were all, he was a larger-than-life character, which just means he's fat, right?
Yeah.
One off force of nature, all of that, sort of ignoring the facts. Sort of.
Yeah.
And then, until the Independent came along, I actually wrote he was a liar, a cheat, and a bully. Well done, the Independent.
Yeah, that's great, because it was like, yes. Yeah, so actually, I remember thinking at the time, yes, you just told it like it was. Sort of broke the tradition of obituaries, really. And just
I hate all this don't speak ill of the dead, you know, and you can't say that when they're dead. You go, you can if they were an arsehole.
Yeah, yeah.
You having been a narcissistic, abusive, horrible bully just because you're dead, does it?
This was before it all came out about the missing millions. And they'd stolen the money of the pensioners who worked for the Mirror. So this is like over the next few weeks, it became apparent that he was a massive,
there were millions not
fraudster.
Accounted for, right?
Yeah.
So the authorities come after his sons to try and find out what's happened to whatever was in the pension pot. And there's the great news footage of the doorbell at Kevin Maxwell's house being rung by the police in the morning. And his wife sort of opens up the window and says, go away or we'll call the police. And they say, madam, we are the police.
It's great sort of comic timing from the copper. Madam, we are the police. It's the madam which does it, I think. But Kevin will be declared bankrupt. Kevin had debts of 406 million.
Easy done, John, isn't it?
You run out your credit card, you don't pay it off.
Biggest bankrupt in history.
That's amazing. But
that's the thing, is it, how people are ever allowed to borrow that amount? Well, this is what we're talking about, isn't it? Once you're super rich, you can borrow until kingdom come.
Of a really long fraud trial, but Kevin and Ian were found not guilty. So, right. They played the rule that they were sort of bullied into it by their
I mean, it's hard to know, isn't it, at what point you go, well, they were obviously victims. All his children were victims of an abusive father. But it's hard to know also how much agency they had as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, quite. None of the family, I should say, believed he would ever commit suicide. That was the first thing Betty said. Ghislaine remains convinced to this day that he was murdered. She set about restoring their family name, and I think that's been going pretty well for her, actually.
Oh, don't. Let's not go down that road with Ghislaine Maxwell. No. But
he became this terrible supervillain from the mirror going, the man who saved the mirror, to, the man who stole all our
screwed us
pensions.
All over.
Yeah, that was a pretty fast about turn. Now he's sort of, you look back at this life of this monster and think, how did he just keep getting away with it? How did he steal, lie, cheat, bully for so long? Everyone knew how appalling he was, and yet people were willing to lend him money because they thought they could make a quick buck.
And they thought exactly they were making money too, weren't they? So, so it sort of still remains a mystery, doesn't it? Really, what happened to him? But
I think he committed suicide myself. That seems like the obvious.
It seems like the things were closing in, weren't they? And
I like the he was too nice theory. I think that's got a narrative about it.
I think there was something in the book about how his arms were. When they found him, and his arms were above his head, and it looked like there was sort of some muscle tear or something. It looked like he'd been holding on to something and lost his grip. And there was some theories that was exactly. There was a theory that was, you know, him that he'd fallen and grabbed on something. Yeah. But actually, I think if you do kill yourself, you don't necessarily, you know, it might take you a while to actually, you might hang there for a bit, mightn't you, before you let go.
Exactly. You know? So that's what I think.
Headington
Hall is now leased by Oxford Brookes University School of Law. Ironically, students there have a little idea quite how many laws were broken in that building.
Yeah, how ironic.
And do you know what happened to the yacht, Angela?
I do, John. It is now owned by one of the Murdochs.
What a twist that is.
What a twist in the tale.
I'm not sure they knew when they bought it because its name had
apparently they didn't. No, the name had changed and they didn't find out till later that it was the old Lady Ghislaine.
Yeah. So that's the life and times of Robert Maxwell. Read Fall by John Preston.
Read the book. It is an interesting read. I know I just find it difficult reading about men like this, but...
It's got some amazing stories in it. There's one story about this Japanese fascist that goes to see the Queen with the son Ian, and he prostrates himself on the floor and gives a high-pitched shriek, and the Queen's going, "He can get up now."
It's all rather embarrassing.
Some great little sort of anecdotal stories. That's what John Preston's so good at. He'll always do a detour for a great bit of storytelling.
Absolutely. So do read the book.
Give us 5 stars.
On the old iTunes or wherever you do your podding. Follow us at We Are History Pod and do
tell your friends.
Keep an eye out. Like we said in the last episode, we will be eventually doing some live shows, hopefully, if we can make that work. So that will be good to meet some of you.
Yeah, great. In the meantime, catch you next week on We Are History. Thanks for listening.
We will.
And see you next time.
Bye.